Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
This is a project for Alaskans by Alaskans, and so the sustainability will be dependent on Alaskans.
Officials are in Anchorage this week to discuss how to use an influx of rural healthcare funds. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, January 15th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, 2 new pilot programs seek to lower overdose deaths with a medication that reduces withdrawal symptoms.
We have something that can help engage people that's super safe and it's cheap and that it works.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
The PFD application is open. Just a small amount of your PFD will help share local news and stories about Alaskans with Alaskans across this great state when you choose Alaska Public Media through Pick, Click, Give.
The Alaska Court of Appeals today took up the case of a Whittier woman indicted in 2023 on felony charges of voter misconduct. Like others born in American Samoa, Tupe Smith is a U.S. national but not a U.S. citizen. Smith says she thought that meant she could vote in local elections but not presidential elections. When filling out voter registration forms in the past, Smith and her lawyers say a Whittier city official told her to check a box that said she was a U.S. citizen, even though Smith knew she wasn't, because the forms did not have a box for U.S. national. That led to an investigation by Alaska State Troopers, who arrested Smith in late November 2023. Now, one of the main sticking points is whether the words knowingly and intentionally mean the same thing in regards to a person making a false statement on a voter registration form. Smith's attorney, Whitney Brown, told the 3-judge appeals court panel today that they do not mean the same thing. In writing the law on voter misconduct, Brown says the legislature used both terms differently and therefore they should be understood differently.
The record also reflects that if she had known that she was not supposed to vote, she would not have done so. So the state has just shown no evidence of an intent to mislead or deceive. So we believe that the court in this instance can take the extra step of just dismissing the indictment.
That request to dismiss the indictment comes after a superior court judge denied Smith's bid to have the case tossed. The Court of Appeals agreed to hear Smith's case at the hearing today. The state wants the appeals court to send the case back to the superior court for a final decision. The state's attorneys argue that the words intentionally and knowingly can mean the same thing. On that point, there was this exchange today between Chief Appeals Court Judge Marjorie Allard and Assistant Attorney General Kayla Doyle.
If the issue is that you have to intentionally, meaning you have to want to make a false statement, there's certainly an argument that if you don't think it's a false statement, if you think that for these purposes, I'm supposed to write down that I'm a U.S. citizen, then that's a defense, and perhaps the grand jury would not have indicted.
I have 2 points on that, Your Honor. First, I think we blur the language a little bit. It's not that she didn't know what she was writing was false. It's that she thought she was supposed to write something that she knew was false for these specific purposes. And that's a little bit different.
Doyle agreed with Brown that it was a difficult but important case, and there were multiple puns, intended or not, made in today's oral arguments about how intentional the legislature had been in including the word intentional in the law on voter misconduct. The appeals court will make a decision in the case at a later date, though it's unclear when that will be. Hundreds of healthcare workers and government officials are descending on Anchorage this week for the kickoff of a 5-year, $1.3 billion program aimed at reimagining medical care across Alaska. The money comes from the Rural Health Transformation Program created by President Trump's signature tax and spending cut legislation passed last summer, the same legislation that pares back Medicaid. Alaska Public Media's Eric Stone reports.
The problem is no secret, says the state's former chief medical officer, Dr. Ann Zink.
We consistently see that people who live in rural areas, Alaska and beyond, have worse health outcomes with increased cost. And this is an opportunity to rethink the way that care is delivered to make sure no matter where you live, you have access to quality, timely, effective care.
Zink is working with the State Department of Health as it rolls out the program and spoke on a video call with reporters and state officials. Alaska's Rural Health Transformation Program is built around six goals, from improving maternal health, preventive care, and access to health care, to strengthening the workforce and rethinking how doctors and hospitals charge for care. That last point, what the state is calling pay for value, is a big one. Most medical care is what's known as fee for service. You go to the doctor, you get seen, you pay the doctor for their time, whether or not you get better. With pay for value, the idea is you pay for results. And that sounds great, says Department of Health Deputy Commissioner Emily Ricci, but
the realities of making that transition takes time, it's very challenging, and it will look different for every community and every provider and the provider types.
Say you have a rash. You go to the doctor. The doctor sends you to the dermatologist, who then sends you to the pharmacy for a medicated lotion. But does your primary care provider know what the dermatologist prescribed? Does your dermatologist know that your regular doctor tried that same medication with that hard-to-pronounce name 6 months ago? And does anyone know if you eventually get better? Maybe not. And Ricci says that's a problem they'd like to solve.
So how can we use this funding to begin now, over the next 5 years, building out kind of the infrastructure, the concepts, the protocols, the data that providers need in order to kind of make that transition?
So technology is one point of focus for the first of what the Department of Health says will be a series of multi-day workshops in Anchorage. Health Commissioner Heidi Hedberg says the meetings, they're calling them convenings, are an effort to get as many stakeholders involved as possible, from cities and tribes to hospitals, medical providers, and vendors.
This funding is really to support what the community and region need, and every community and every region needs something different.
Under the $50 billion nationwide program, Alaska will receive roughly $273 million per year for 5 years. Hedberg calls it generational. But the elephant in the room, of course, is that the same tax cut legislation that created the program could also push many Alaskans away from the healthcare system, says Alaska Hospital and Healthcare Association head Jared Kosin.
I appreciate and I see the bright side and the good things. Looking ahead, I talk about coverage disruptions with these enhanced premium tax credits expiring. We talk about coverage disruptions with the tightening of Medicaid ineligibility right around the corner.
And he says that would push healthcare costs up, because when people can't pay, hospitals have no choice but to shift those costs onto those who can. Kosin says he's also concerned the transition to a new administration after Governor Mike Dunleavy's term ends later this year could throw a wrench in the state's plans. Still, Dr. Zink is optimistic. She says the state's efforts to involve a wide range of stakeholders will help limit disruptions.
This is a project for Alaskans by Alaskans, and so the sustainability will be dependent on Alaskans.
Zink says she'd like Alaska to serve as a model for rural healthcare across the country. With additional reporting by Rachel Cassandra, reporting in Juneau, I'm Eric Stone.
Dave Bronson has picked a U.S. Marine Corps veteran and financial advisor to join him in his bid for governor. Bronson, a Republican and the former mayor of Anchorage, announced Joshua Church as his choice for lieutenant governor Wednesday at a car dealership in Fairbanks. Bronson says they're aligned ideologically and that geography played a role in the selection.
I have a blind spot in this spot a little bit, and it's called the interior. And I knew right away that if I was going to do a good job as a governor, I'd have to have a running mate that understood everything that was going on up here, because all the mining, all the gas line stuff, it's all going to be supported through this city and this borough.
Bronson also said he made the pick because of Church's background in finance. Church lives in Fairbanks and works in wealth management and financial planning. He's served on a handful of local committees and commissions and is currently a member of the City of Fairbanks Finance Committee. In a speech Wednesday, Church pointed to numerous things he sees as problems for the state, including high energy costs and a budget crisis. The lieutenant governor in Alaska is tasked with administering state election laws, and Church says he'd want to pursue election reforms if they take office.
If we can't all be confident that we have safe, secure, and accurate elections, none of the rest of this will matter.
Bronson is one of 14 candidates currently in the 2026 governor's race. He served a single term as Anchorage mayor before losing to current Mayor Suzanne LaFrance in 2024. Governor Mike Dunleavy appointed him manager of Ted Stevens Anchorage International Airport last year, a post he resigned after 8 months. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an Indigenous-focused domestic violence helpline is working to expand in Alaska.
I think when survivors reach out to non-Native organizations or resources, they kind of have to over-explain their experience.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Avery Elfelt, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media, KHNS, where I work in Haines, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news on Alaska News Nightly or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
The North Slope village of Anaktuvik Pass has been short on fuel for about a week amid frigid temperatures. Local officials say several homes ran out of heating fuel and the school closed for several days. The North Slope borough declared an emergency last Friday and fuel deliveries resumed. But officials say the reserves remain low. Acting City Mayor Matt Regan says that prolonged severe weather and mechanical issues with aircraft have disrupted fuel deliveries to the community of about 400 residents. Temperatures there have dropped below negative 45, with wind chills reaching minus 65. Regan says planes could not land for several days because of ice fog. Regan says residents had to conserve fuel as best they could. He says school was canceled because there was no gas to pick up students and it was too cold for them to walk to classes. Regan says the village's main fuel carrier, Everett's Air Cargo, resumed fuel deliveries late last week, and Wright Air Services and Ryanair have also been helping deliver gas. The borough estimated that a total of 18,500 gallons of fuel were delivered this week. Borough officials said the emergency declaration allowed them to deliver fuel using the ice road, also known as the Community Winter Access Trail, without waiting for routine state and federal approvals. Regan says fuel is not running out anymore, but the city is still at minimum levels. He said in a brief phone call today, quote, "That got us out of the emergency, but we're not out of the fire yet," end quote. A snowstorm and blizzard conditions are forecast for the area ahead of the weekend. A semi-tractor trailer loaded with explosives slid off a slick stretch of the Alaska Highway Tuesday, a couple miles east of Delta Junction. Alaska state troopers say the explosives did not detonate and the driver was not injured. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Troopers got a report at around 9:15 Tuesday night about the wreck near milepost 1418. The northbound truck hit the ditch and plowed about 100 feet into a stand of black spruce. The tractor was heavily damaged, but according to a trooper dispatch, the cargo in the trailer remained intact with no damage or spillage. The dispatch said the wrecked truck posed no risk of explosion and was not a public safety hazard, but it added, quote, "Due to the nature of the cargo, Alaska State Troopers will remain on scene until recovery operations begin," unquote. Two large wreckers removed the truck and trailer late Wednesday afternoon. A trooper spokesperson said winter road conditions were a contributing factor to the wreck. According to the State Department of Transportation, that stretch of the Alaska Highway has ice patches and snow. The temperature in the area Tuesday night was 20 below zero. The spokesperson said the truck was owned and operated by Tri-State Motor Transportation, an Arizona-based company. The Tri-State website says it specializes in high-security transportation. According to the spokesperson, the truck was delivering the explosives to a facility in Salcha, operated by Orica USA, an Australia-based company. And an Orica spokesperson based in Colorado confirmed in an email this morning that the truck was delivering blasting materials to its Salcha facility. In Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska is launching pilot programs in Anchorage and Juneau to offer addiction treatment in mobile care units. Emergency responders will give people medication to help them make it through a critical window when overdose survivors are at high risk of dying. Alaska Public Media's health reporter Rachel Cassandra has more on how the programs can help people get into recovery.
Dr. Jennifer Pierce shows off a new SUV.
It is not really marked.
For the Anchorage Fire Department's pilot program.
People. We want people to see us as a beacon of help.
Pierce has a simple mission, to treat Anchorage residents who overdose and connect them with care afterwards. For the first time in a mobile unit in Alaska, responders can give patients the medication buprenorphine.
For when we respond on scenes, we can provide that
very quickly.
Which reduces withdrawals and can get patients on the road to recovery.
We don't want people to fall through the cracks.
Narcan, or naloxone, is used to reverse overdoses, but it puts people into withdrawal. And research shows that offering that second medication, buprenorphine, makes it more likely patients will enter a long-term recovery. But Pierce says even if people don't continue treatment, the medication reduces the risk of a second overdose in the days immediately following, a dangerous window, according to research. She hopes the program saves lives.
Even if it's just one life, right? We're saving lives out there and preventing individuals maybe from overdosing the next day or overdosing again later and dying.
Pierce visited successful programs in Texas and Washington for ideas and best practices to replicate in Alaska. Seth Workentine is an addiction medicine specialist in Juneau and consulted for the pilot there. He says offering patients buprenorphine has several benefits. It lasts much longer than Narcan, at least 24 hours, protecting people from re-entering overdose. And he says buprenorphine reduces feelings of withdrawal.
And withdrawal is an extremely uncomfortable experience, hated by almost everyone who's ever experienced it, and is often a barrier to people seeking treatment.
But buprenorphine is an opioid, and Workentine says he's heard critics of programs like these argue that it's just swapping one drug for another. But he says buprenorphine is different, and over time, it actually reverses the brain changes that happen with addiction.
So it's not replacing one for the other, even though they're in the same category. It is actually part of healing.
He says that's integral to the recovery process. Dr. Quigley Peterson says he's also seen the healing benefits of buprenorphine. He's an emergency room physician heading Juno's mobile pilot program. He says he's confident it will do well, partly because he's seen how helpful the medication can be in the emergency room.
We have something that can help engage people that's super safe and it's cheap and that it works.
He says they'll collect data over the year to see what happens to patients after they're given buprenorphine for an overdose. His hope is that it reduces emergency room visits and calls for emergency medical care. And he says that would be good for the mental health of emergency responders, too, who get burnt out responding to the same patients over and over. He says if you can get them into long-term care,
then you won't need to see them in the future. You won't have these recurrent EMS calls.
If the pilots are successful, Peterson's goal is to inspire similar programs in more communities across Alaska. In Anchorage, I'm Rachel Cassandra.
The State Department of Natural Resources is moving forward with its effort to overhaul how it manages one of Alaska's three state forests. Agency staff are in Haines this week to meet with a range of local groups to solicit input to inform the new plan, which would open the entire Haines State Forest to logging. The Alaska Desk's Avery Elfelt reports.
Governor Mike Dunleavy, in late 2024, directed the State Division of Forestry to boost the timber industry in Southeast Alaska, particularly in the Haines State Forest. That prompted State Forester Greg Palmieri to start reworking the plan that dictates how the forest is used, including for timber. The new version would also need to accommodate another Dunleavy policy, the sale of carbon credits. The major change moving forward, Palmieri says, is that the management plan would allow for timber harvest in the entire forest, as opposed to about half of it.
Prior to that was 42,000 acres. Well, now there's 74,360 acres available for access for that type of resource management.
A draft plan is currently in the works, but it hasn't yet been released to the public. First, the agency will meet with local groups, including tribes, the Haines Borough, and various advisory committees. Palmieri says those meetings will inform the draft, which should be released for public comment this spring.
If we're going to do this here, what do you think is the most appropriate way to do it to protect the interests that you represent? That's the meaningful contribution that we're trying to, you know, acquire at this time.
Take, for instance, state forest land near Chilkoot Lake that previously was not available for timber harvest. Palmieri says the new plan could specify that even though some timber harvest in the area may be on the table, clear cutting is not. The conversations so far have focused more on the state's process and overarching goal of boosting logging in the area than on specific forestry-related recommendations. This week, forestry officials met with a group that advises the state on how to manage the Alaska Chilkat Bald Eagle Preserve. Some committee members, including Bill Thomas, seemed supportive of the effort.
People forget
was it for the logging industry, you wouldn't have access out here anywhere.
Others, including Haines Mayor Tom Morfitt, questioned the intent and potential outcome for local people.
The state, I think, is going to have to make a lot better job explaining why it wants to start logging on recreation lands. What's the benefit to the community? That's what I'd like to see.
Others still voiced confusion over the process and how they were supposed to weigh in on the issue without seeing the current draft or specific questions from the state. Members of the Area Fish and Game Advisory Committee have raised the same sentiment during their own meetings. Both committees indicated this week that they plan to provide more specific forestry-related feedback to the state in the near future. In Haines, I'm Avery Elfelt.
Anchorage and the Mat-Su could see icy and flooded roads starting this evening and lasting through the weekend as snow, rain, and warmer temperatures move in. National Weather Service meteorologist Virginia Rux says temperatures will hover at or just above freezing, creating tricky travel conditions.
Travel is going to be really difficult, and to make sure to plan ahead, consider rearranging your plans if you can, and then planning extra time to reach your destination.
Anchorage and the Matanuska-Susitna Borough remain under a winter weather advisory until 9 p.m. tomorrow. On top of that, Anchorage's hillside and higher elevations of Eagle River are also under a high wind warning through noon tomorrow, with gusts up to 85 miles per hour and the possibility of widespread power outages. The forecasted rain paired with the wind prompted the Anchorage School District to cancel most activities and after-school programs today. Rux says the icy conditions will likely continue into the weekend. Kenny Friendly with Anchorage Public Works says plow crews are finishing up snow removal today and preparing to deal with the ice.
As far as iced areas, they're really going to focus on sanding to make sure that Anchorage residents can be safe on their commutes.
There's also an avalanche warning in effect for the Anchorage hillside, Girdwood, and mountains farther south. Ruck says it's extremely dangerous to venture into the backcountry in the current conditions. A national domestic violence helpline is expanding its services to Alaska Native people through a new branch. As KYUK's Samantha Watson reports, the extension aims to keep culture and the reality of rural communities at the heart of its service.
There are several national hotlines for survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault, but experts say for those facing a painful situation, it can help to speak with someone who can understand some context.
We are culturally honoring or culturally appropriate, meaning we are designed, we're designed by and for American Indians and Alaska Natives.
That's Rachel Karshunk. She is a citizen of the Sioux St. Marie Chippewa Indians and the Deputy Executive Officer of Strong Hearts Native Helpline. Since launching in 2017, the helpline has expanded to become a 24-hour call center for sexual assault and domestic violence survivors. It's staffed by Indigenous board operators and is anonymous for callers.
Currently, we do have over 20 advocates across the United States, but we recognized that, we are kind of missing the mark in Alaska.
Karshunk says the organization recognized that Alaska Native people experience some of the highest rates of domestic violence in the country, in a region whose most remote parts are unique from the rest of the U.S. Strong Hearts set out to build a branch of the call line specifically for Alaska, with phone operators that could have its landscape and cultures in mind. It hired Minnie Snetty, the organization's sexual assault services specialist.
And I always tease people like, oh, first time I get hired for being a village girl.
Snetty grew up in Hooper Bay. She says she knows how the remoteness of some Alaska Native communities can make it harder to access consistent help.
Not being able to be seen due to the lack of behavioral health aids or lack of, clinicians, the high turnover rates of counselors and therapists in the region.
Snetty's position aims to help fill in the gaps and to develop a call line that's reliable support. It's about being a resource to help things from slipping through the cracks.
A lot of them go, go through the loops. And hopefully, you know, Strong Hearts Native Helpline can be there to help. And the majority of the time, are the victims just want to be heard, you know, or at least someone to talk to.
Beyond the one-on-one support of the call line, Strong Hearts also was able to connect survivors with resources in their communities. Snetty says in building the Alaska branch, she's been collecting resources in each community. Phone numbers for health clinics, law enforcement, legal support, and regional shelters for survivors. Eventually, Strong Hearts plans to hire additional Alaska Native advocates to support the Alaska call line. Karshunk says that's part of why Strong Hearts Native Helpline was created, to help provide a deeper level of understanding.
I think when survivors reach out to non-Native organizations or resources, they kind of have to over-explain their experience, especially when it comes to like historical trauma or just things that are very unique to Indigenous cultures. I think, you know, that it kind of puts a barrier up for a lot of folks.
The organization plans to launch its Alaska Native-specific call line later this year. It will be a separate phone number survivors will be able to call or text. Until then, anyone can still call or text Strong Hearts mainline to be connected with an advocate in the lower 48. That number is 1-844-762-8483. That's 1-844-762-8483. In Bethel, I'm Samantha Watson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Eric Stone in Juneau, Rachel Cassandra, Aliona Niden, and Hannah Floor in Anchorage, Patrick Gilchrist in Fairbanks, Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, Avery Elfelt in Haines, and Samantha Watson in Bethel. Our audio engineer tonight is Dave Waldron, Madeline Rose is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.